Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We seem to hear maybe a little bit of a buzz on the line there, or maybe my headphones are just turned up too high. That's exactly what it is. It's on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week, ladies and gentlemen, from Monday till Thursday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Central, and 10 p.m. Eastern. I'm still a little bit fuzzy as to what it is in Greenwich Mean Time. It might be midnight, which is really, really the witching hour for conspiracy theorists. I must say, I have been up many a night looking into certain forms of scumbaggery, completely unable to sleep or blink more than once every 15 minutes. My very special guest joining me now today is one of my favourite military researchers who was literally a librarian at the Department of Defense at one time. His name's Douglas Dietrich. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
It's great to be here, Vincent, and it's great to be a guest on your program once again. Believe me, we haven't done this in all too long a period of time. It feels like forever, and I'm really glad that American Freedom Radio is back on the air and that we can get together on this venue once again.
Well, it is due time. I interviewed something. I don't know what your feeling is on the whole World War III scenario, but let me lay something on you. Mm-hmm. Certain people say that World War III has basically been called off. Do you agree with that sort of idea? I mean, is there even a World War III in the works? And if there was, how exactly would they go about one if they wanted to?
Well, a World War III is kind of like a really, shall I say, nebulous topic because it's almost meaningless in today's environment. We've got an environment in which, as a military historian, I try to get people aware of what kind of wars that we're dealing with. And by the way, I'm getting the kind of background noise that you are as well.
Yeah, I'm getting that too.
Yeah, that was coming through while I was on mute. So I know it's not me if you could hear it then, because it's not coming from my headphones, but I'm getting it in my headphones. And what I think it is this communal high that Vincent and I got on the other night when we were experimenting with various drugs, because this day today, April 16th, back in 1943, is when the hallucinogenic effects of acid were discovered. So we went into a bit of astral tripping there, and we brought it back with us, I'm afraid, dear listeners. So you're going to be stuck with this beaming out of our brains until something can be found to technologically block it for all of you. Until then, you're stuck in our high. But part of that high is the delusion or the data matrix in which all too many Americans are stuck, as well as Westerners in general. That would include the Britons, and that would include everyone in the Commonwealth of English-speaking nations. And a lot of that data matrix has to do with the fantasy of the Third World War. Now, make no mistake about it, there is very much a lot of killing, a lot of death, a lot of genocide going on, and all of that together kind of makes a Third World War rather redundant. When people think of a Third World War, of course, classically, what they are thinking of is the mobilization of forces towards a effort of on a civilizational level where societies are in conflict and they seek to destroy each other. Now, this has occurred many times in history. There were many global wars prior to the Napoleonic conflicts. But one of the problems that we ran into with the Napoleonic conflicts that had never existed before was the fact that we are basically in a situation where all societies and populations are used as a battlefield. Until around the time of the Napoleonic Wars in Europe, this did not occur. Now, the Napoleonic Wars were indicative of something different in modern European wars. Instead of just nations that were fighting for colonies that were miles away, half the world away, the Dutch in Indonesia, and the islands of New Zealand were just beginning to be brought into awareness of the people in Europe. The continent of Australia wasn't even fully mapped out as a coastline. At that period in time, we still had basically soldiers fighting soldiers and maybe killing civilians that were far away. Now, the civilians would get a lot of ire, they would get a lot of grief, they would suffer atrocity, rape, new diseases, and this, of course, had its most apocalyptic effect on the entire world in the Western Hemisphere, where the indigenous populations began to die off. And I think that's something important for us to get into on a personal level with myself as we go into the program, because a lot of people ask where I'm coming from personally, and I think that that is very important when I'm trying to give them this perspective of history that many people find repugnant or reprehensible or disturbing. So we can get into that later in the show with your permission. I'll let you guide it into that direction. But I'll tell you something that happened with the Napoleonic Wars, or what effectively became World War Zero.
But just before you do, can you just mute your microphone for a second? I want to test something.
Well, I just got an email from my executrix producer who's listening to the program. She says the audience isn't hearing anything, but I'll go mute. Just know that she's not hearing anything, and much of the listenership is not.
Okay. Well, if you just... No, that didn't solve the buzz. Okay, you can unmute.
Yeah.
I mean, we can soldier on through it. You know, it's just I don't know what the hell it is. We can both hear it, but nobody else can. Isn't that just the oddest thing?
Well, it just goes to show, Vinny, you and I have got to stop doing acid. I mean, we've got to share.
I know, seriously, because we've got to stop doing acid because we need to kill this buzz.
Yes, I know. We're buzzed right now, and nobody else can feel our buzz. This is the saddest thing in the world when you've got a shared high and nobody else can feel it. So, Vinny and I will soldier on through.
Okay, now, the Napoleonic complex is very important to me.
Yes.
Because I'm 6'4", and I've had to deal with a lot of very, very short little Napoleonic Sasquatch hairy little men trying to knock me out. Like, they're trying to, like, reach up, and it's comical. It's like watching a child try to get the cookies on top of the kitchen cupboard.
I'm afraid I'd be one of those in a sense at this point in my physical history. I used to be 5'11". Now I'm 5'7", ever since an automobile accident with a taxi cab in San Francisco, at a period of time when we had a lot of foreign drivers that came from basically the Soviet Central Asiatic Republics, or what used to be the Soviet Central Asiatic Republics. Many of these places had no roads whatsoever, certainly none that were paved in any regions outside of the extreme metropolitan areas, like, say, the central capital of a major region. Other than that, there was a lot of off-road driving. They were in San Francisco, one of the smallest congested areas in the world in terms of a tiny little peninsula on which the entire city is developed. And as a result, the cabs charge two or three times the amount they charge in any other city in the world, because otherwise the cab drivers wouldn't make any money. The cab driver that was driving myself and my mother drove up the wrong street in the wrong direction and into an 18-wheeler truck. I threw myself over my mother, and he's very fortunate that he died as the front of the cab crumpled, or I would have killed him myself. And as for myself, my spine was impacted. My mother, miraculously, was entirely unscratched. And after that, of course, they told me that I was going to be paralyzed. I recovered ambulation, but nevertheless, my spine contracted from that terrible accident by about 2.5 inches, which is the classic result of a major automobile accident. And of course, with age, I've shrunk a little bit more. So since that time, I've had to wear platforms just to keep up with taller individuals such as yourself. And I would like to ask, because we're speaking of physical size, what about, and I'm going to try and pronounce this correctly, please correct me if I'm saying it wrong, the Maori, what is their average height compared to the Europeans who have settled into New Zealand over the generations?
Just same old, you know, average height,
okay.
As far as I know.
Okay, so they're not necessarily shorter or larger than the European settlers that have come to...
Not necessarily. Them and us, you know, whatever racial group you're from, we're all eating Chinese takeaways, Kentucky Fried Chicken, growth hormones, aspartame, and fluoridated communities, you know. I mean, like, so we're all growing up and getting shrunk back down around the same rate. So I think it kind of brings us together in a way.
Okay, well, that's a nice way of looking at it. Speaking of which, before I lose it and get back to Napoleon, in terms of New Zealand, a lot of the elitist cabal is settling into New Zealand these days, which goes into the World War III theme that we were originally speaking about. Obviously, one thing that leads people to expect that a major global conflagration, if not a major global conflict, is emergent or impending, is the fact that so many people are settling into New Zealand, which, of course, as civilized areas go, is about as far away from the rest of the world as you can get. So you're going to see, perhaps, the flavor of New Zealander civilization itself changing, because many of these people have done terrible and horrible things, or administered, or given the oversight, or the orders, at least, or at least owned an army of financial rapists and accountants and bookkeepers who have done the dirty job for them. And many of them are going to New Zealand in case it all comes down. So you're the most popular place in the world, probably even more so than Argentina. It depends on which one's getting a bit more UV radiation at this point in our atmospheric disintegration. So I'm just wondering, do you feel that there's any more of the darker side of this kind of elitist culture with its trickle-down effect as we have in America, where there's a lot of kind of emergence of... for lack of a better word, a quasi-satanic or a popular satanic culture that becomes basically disseminated. Is that going on around you, Vinny, or is that something that, I mean, you would know. Basically, you're the guy who's got the only 24-hour-a-day conspiracy show that was on for years before anyone else pioneered this where you're at.
Yeah. In fact, still the only one who does it more or less daily in the entire country in terms of alternative and conspiracy talk radio, and I've been going for 5 years. The average person lasts in talk radio about 3 months. So anyway, after interviewing hundreds, I'll probably say hundreds of New Zealand activists across the broad spectrum. So we have a massive satanic infiltration here. We have Freemasons, really high-level Freemasons, are overrepresented positions of power. The country's largest city, the current mayor and former mayor are 32nd and 33rd degree Freemasons, respectively. The current prime minister is 32nd degree, the Scottish Rite. So I don't know exactly how that works when the three most powerful men in the country all belong to the same lodge, but... On top of that, we have massive child trafficking going on here. We're seeing reports of fathers having their kids taken off them and hired out to people who are related into gangs and things of this nature. Allegedly, five of the current sitting members of parliament for the ruling party, the National Party, are implicated in child sex offences or child abuse or something like that. And, of course, the government's hushed it up. There's also a massive corruption problem in New Zealand in terms of having a very incestuous nature and a very difficulty getting accurate appeals, because out of, I think there's 180 high court justices in the country, give or take, and I think like 126 of them are first cousin at least. So if you get a wrongful conviction by one person, the chances are you're going to get a wrongful conviction again. And it's extremely corrupt. The police were reported in the mainstream media as having approximately, and this is a very, very watered down statistic, by the way, because they didn't include just frontline staff, but also all administrative staff, approximately 10% of the police force liable for corruption. So it's quite a bad situation we have here. We dump 1080 poison into the bushland, pristine bushland, with the pretext of killing what are native to Australia, possums, which apparently eat berries and stuff. And there's fluoride in the water. We got chemtrails all over the place with the transponders off. We've checked. Shoot me.
So you're becoming part of the rest of the web, and basically...
One last thing.
Yeah.
Operation Catapo. A catapo is the most poisonous and dangerous spider in New Zealand. Operation Catapo was the largest foreign troop movement on New Zealand soil since World War II. We had a huge amount of American troops here, and they were doing a mock drill of a beach landing with the pretext that they were there to depose a democratically elected dictator. And they had local people playing roles. They were holding anti-US flags and protest banners and things of that nature. And the operation was how to clear the beaches, take out the protesters, and depose the prime minister. And that happened about a year and a half ago. And also we've got Ohakia Air Base that's recently being upgraded to have house 10 new helicopters. But they've had all these other extensive upgrades, which have cost tens upon tens of millions of dollars just for a few choppers. So that's very suspicious as well. We're also implicated in the Five Eyes network. So Operation Echelon, Project Echelon, sorry, which was signed between all the Five Eyes nations, basically all the English-speaking countries that you can think of, to all collectively share information and spy on each other, because it's illegal for them to collect information on their own people and share it, but it ain't illegal if you collect information on other people's and share it with the people that you stole it from.
Right, right. Absolutely correct. And that's been going on for quite some time now. I believe that Project Echelon got its start maybe half a decade to a decade ago. Am I incorrect on that, or does my memory serve me well?
It might even be late 90s. You know, it's kind of like, it comes down to semantics, you know? Right. If what date something happened and such and blah, 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 often it doesn't really matter if the point of fact is that it's currently going on right now with overarching consequences. But that said, accuracy is still very important if you're going to be relaying and telling people this is a fact. Know what they are. And unfortunately, I don't have the exact date on me.
Understood. Don't worry about it. And as you say, it's almost a moot point. That brings us back to the Third World War we were all speaking of. Definitely what is going on is that Mr. Eastwood has confirmed all of my worst fears. And I want the audience to know that. My worst fears are, of course, you've got what was known as one of the most pristine and lovely areas on the face of this planet, New Zealand, with a kind of environment that is unique and an ecological system that it used to be quite pristine, is becoming increasingly just violated. And
approximately 25% of our beaches you now can't swim in, and about half of the rivers and lakes as well. But it's clean and green, New Zealand, you know.
but how is this? You're not an industrial superpower. What kind of industries are doing this?
Oh, you have no idea how much crap we have to put up with from farming. Cows, mate. We provide enough food for 60 million people, and we're only a country of 4 million, so we export a lot of it, and we keep the cow crap here, where it's safe, directly into the waterways. I was rolling down to a marae. It's a meeting house for Māori elders. That's how you pronounce it, by the way, Māori. And they were rolling past these cows who were in the river, you know, crapping directly into the river. And back in his day, like 50-odd years ago, you had to keep the cows at the very least about 50 to 150 meters away from the river at all times, and then double that distance away from them at night. And now it's become so polluted in our waterways that the only waterways that are guaranteed clean are the ones that are incidentally under the care of Māori trusts. I saw one guy come up, and he was part of a trust that was, I think they were taking care of about 2,500 rivers and waterways to keep them pristine. The government was in charge of about 75,000 rivers and waterways to keep them pristine. Zero of the government's turned out to be pristine when tested afterwards, and 100% of the ones these trustees were taking care of turned out pristine.
Right. Well, I definitely want to thank you for articulating that, because that's so important to know. I do want to get a bit more into a kind of an analogy between I'm going to take a while to get it right, and I may never get it right, the Māori. Is that
you,
coming
you know,
close?
Okay, have you ever had a moldy bread?
Yes, okay.
Say the word moldy.
Moldy.
And then try to add an R into it. Mold, okay. Māori.
Okay, Māori. Māori. And definitely
Māori. Māori. There we go, bro. It's good.
Okay, thank you. And I do want to give them the respect that they deserve as an indigenous population that is struggling for independence and hopefully autonomy because of what you just described. Obviously, they're far better care providers for that nature which their population adapted to millennia beforehand than many of the European settlers and what they are doing with their entirely alien economic system and their biological imperialism of cow worship. Well, the worship of the sacred cow.
Well, what happens with every indigenous culture that gets assimilated by the British is that a whole bunch of really nasty people tend to marry into the royal and chiefly bloodlines or whatever. And then they wound up turning on their own people, keeping a lot of the wealth, rights, lands, etc., and opportunities for themselves, and letting their people live in poverty with nothing but alcohol addiction and terrible food to sustain them, with very little education. While those who sit on the heads of some trusts who masquerade as doing something good for the community drive around in $80,000 Dodge Rams, right, and send their children to tens of thousand dollar a year private schools.
Right. Well, this is just, of course, appalling, but none of it is surprising. Obviously, the British system is by no means necessarily unique. It is different from the American system. What we have here, of course, was the eradication of the Native American Indian tribes. Most people are unfamiliar with this kind of history because it's never taught in school.
Douglas, yeah. I'll stop you there. The British tried eradicating the Maori, and they failed because the Maori were better at war than them.
Yes, absolutely.
So they had to do this thing called a treaty where they said, hey, bro, you know how we can't beat you in battle? Yeah. Well, why don't we just make peace, bro? You know, and we'll just live here in peace and stuff. All you have to do is just sign this document, seceding right. your sovereignty.
Right. And that, of course, resulted in basically the situation as it exists today until something radical takes place. And
Resulted in a war. Like the biggest New Zealand wars between the British and the Maori occurred after the treaty happened.
I'm not surprised. No, thank you for clarifying that. No, that's very important. Definitely one of the things that I can go into in terms of the American culture would be the fact that the Native American wars were very much a part of American life until the 1970s, which is entirely alien to American knowledge. They actually believe it stopped around with the death of Geronimo in just shortly before the First World War, as it's called in popular history. And so the Americans think it was all kind of settled after that. We all started learning to live together. And the reality is nothing could be further from the truth. I myself am about 1/14th to 1/16th, just this pittance, basically what you would call an octoroon, meaning 1/8. And by the 16th and the 14th, I'm talking about 12 to 16% is what they say it by bloodline heritage in terms of the Mandan tribe of North America, which is up by the North Dakotas and of all things, long, long ago, apparently interbred with the Welsh. And the Welsh apparently came to North America sometime after the Vikings, but not too long after, and began to interbreed or settle with some of the Indians deep on the North American continent. So the Mandan were always known as essentially one of the white tribes of the North American continent. Now, there's only something like maybe less than 100 pure-blooded Mandan left alive, and that was the last time I checked, which was like the 1990s. I'm certain they're potentially bred out of existence by now. It's because of this reason that we have to use these terms like 12 to 16% bloodline or the octoroon 1/8 Native American blood, because those are the people, such as myself, that are actually counted by the U.S. government for the sake of maintaining its bureaucracy, which used to be the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which no longer exists. We're now all under national parkland or something like that. And the way it maintains any Indians at all for the rest of the world to see is by counting just downbred, watered-down people such as myself. If they didn't do that, there wouldn't be any Native Americans left to count that were of pure blood. Quite literally, they'd be so insignificant that it would be meaningless. They would no longer exist as any kind of group. So many of the people who have been incorporated are adapted peoples. These are basically people who are majority Filipino, majority American, somehow brown-looking enough for the most part where they can get away with looking Indian. Now, be that as it may, I was never awarded an Indian identification number, so I'm still working on that, and I'm getting absolutely no help from many of the Native Americans in the United States because the majority here have a very incestuous and inbred group of their own because they basically are on a governmental system very similar to what you've mentioned in New Zealand. There's a lot of money that comes their way through rights to casinos. If they're way out in the Badlands where the casinos aren't going to matter, then somehow the casino money is supposed to be distributed to their peoples within a trust fund that circulated amongst the Native Americans. The politics, of course, are as ugly as you can imagine, and Native Americans kill each other for casino rights, etc. So it's very much a scene that I'm not quite sure how far I want to investigate in terms of trying to get an Indian registry number or a recognition number by the United States government. But that shows you the kind of situation that I'm in. But what is truly infuriating is that with that, as it may be, as pathetically watered down as that Indian presence is in my bloodstream, basically I have far more of a right to be here in North America by that and that alone as, shall I say, a DNA anchor than the majority of European Americans who constantly are decrying myself on various forms of public media or YouTube as go back to China. This is the kind of ignorance that I have to deal with as someone who has that level of Native American blood. And one of my first impressions, when my parents first moved to San Francisco, they actually came out of Asia. My father was a United States sailor. He had served in the U.S. Navy for over 30 years. He was purely what you would call, except for the little bit of Indian blood in him, white. He was basically German-Irish on one side, kind of French and Native American on the other. Very common combination in North America where the French traders were always going behind the line of the Royal Proclamation that was drawn along the Appalachian Mountains and the Ozarks and the various very soft mountain chains on the eastern seaboard of what was then the nascent American Republic. The United 13 colonies that used to exist on the Atlantic seaboard. And that was one of the primary reasons for the American Revolution. The King of England, in a surprising fit of enlightenment, said that I do not want the rabid puritanical fanatics of the American colonies to go any further. And we're going to leave it to the natives and allow the French to trade with the natives and intermarry with them. But any of these white Anglo-Saxon Protestants going further is just going to result in annihilation of the American Indians. Now, of course, the American Indians were also fine warriors, and they put their all into it with Stone Age implements, and they managed to beat back the European Americans in any number of conflicts. A great example of this would be the Seminole conflict, and the Seminole Indians defeated the United States of America more than once. To the point where they were allowed, of course, control over lands that the Americans didn't want anyway, Americans of European descent, which were the massive Everglades and swamplands of the Floridian Peninsula. And because of that, whenever any escaped African-American slaves from the Deep South during the years of chattel slavery and the southern states before they became a confederacy, during that period of time, all the African-Americans knew was that if they made it into the Everglades, they were safe because the Native Americans, the Seminole Indians, would accept them, would allow them to marry into their tribe. And for that reason, the majority of Seminole Indians, if not all of them, are fairly blackified. The majority of them look like African Americans at this point in history. And a few of them, I remember as a Department of Defense research librarian dealing with documents concerning the American Indian Wars, ran across a very recent document, comparatively speaking, something from the 80s, maybe even the 90s, before I left the Department of Defense completely. And at that period of time, two Seminole Indians had been caught or had conducted a bank robbery. They were not caught. They were pursued ultimately by federal agents. Now, I don't know where the bank robbery, I can't even consciously remember where it was conducted, but if federal agents got involved, they must have crossed state lines. They wound up killing the federal agents, and when this was brought to court and they were going to be railroaded to prison the rest of their lives, an attorney brought it up that, well, you can't do that because the Seminole Indian Nation is still legally at war with the United States. Therefore, they're killing federal agents is an act of war. It is part of that war. And therefore, if you sentence them to jail, you will be committing a war crime, and this will have to go international, and we'll have to bring it to The Hague, after which the Americans backed down and those bank robbers were let free. So this is the kind of situation most Americans are entirely unfamiliar with. Another one was when my father, who was a sailor, met my mother in Asia. Then when I was born, we came over first to New York, where he had been born, upstate New York in the United States. And, of course, my sister and I, for some reason, probably because of my mother's Asian input, our Indian heritage showed itself off very distinctively. And nobody wanted to be around us. The Native Americans are hated and despised and loathed in the upstate New York area, and considered to be born thieves and just bad seed wherever they go. So my parents ultimately had to leave that, and a number of other incidents with my family against my sister and myself. My father moved as far away from New York as he could get while still staying in the continental United States, and that was San Francisco. And when we came here, the first day we got into San Francisco, they had shut the airport down because the TAI, the Tribes of All Indians, or the Indians of All Tribes, IAT, excuse me, I transversed it, the acronym, the IAT, the Indians of All Tribes, had taken over Alcatraz Island. And they took over Alcatraz Island, and they were trying to establish an independent nation state, independent of the Constitutional Republic of the United States, for all Native American Indians to settle on so they could stay on Alcatraz Island as a distinct, autonomous, representative entity for any Indians that were still stranded on the continent. Obviously, not too many people could fit on Alcatraz, so that they would want it to be a foreign representation, independent from the U.S., that would represent the Indians that were still under American oppression. Now, at that point in history, Nixon was president. It was 1971 through 1973, and the Alcatraz Island was now a rebel state, very similar to the Confederate States of America, but dealing with an Indian social entity. And what happened was the Soviet Union, Japan, and the People's Republic of China were threatening recognition, which would mean that if the Americans invaded Alcatraz Island to oust all of the Indians, it would be an act of international violation, as if China had crossed the Taiwan Straits. So because of that, the Americans couldn't invade militarily, even though the Presidio military base was right next to Alcatraz Island. Ultimately, the man who was running it, Richard Oakes Mohawk, who had established that colony of Indians, they sent in an infiltration agent, who I later identified, who killed his daughter. And when they murdered his daughter, his heart broke. He left the island, and the entire population was demoralized. And that's when Nixon ordered all of the San Francisco SWAT teams, the FBI, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, various police agencies to come in and invade the island with military equipment. He couldn't use the Coast Guard because that was a branch of military service, so he had to use all of these police agencies so it could not be internationally decreed or decried as a war or an invasion. It was therefore basically a civil disturbance. And they invaded with all of these arms that made Waco look like nothing. I'm talking about they had rocket launchers, they had bazookas, they rappelled down from helicopters. There was not a single firearm found on that island. It was mostly women and children. The few braves, or the Indian warriors, the men, who were caught, were taken to the mainland where they promptly escaped and took over a missile base behind the hills of the Marin County area of the Greater Bay Area region. And that's when they sent in the military and finished all of them off. But this is a tragedy most Americans are entirely unaware of. Richard Oakes Mohawk, whose daughter had been killed, was later on himself assassinated twice. The first time he was had a bullet put into his brain, he went into a coma. An Indian shaman by the name of Great Bear came and healed him. He was ambulatory, cognizant, and able to function again, and wound up being killed in a pool hall by a child molester who was had a long criminal record of molesting Indian children within Indian daycare centers and reform schools. And he was set free. He never spent a day in jail, and the child molester. And his name was Michael Mason or something of that nature. I can't remember it, but it'd be easy enough to find out, the man who killed Richard Oakes Mohawk. But it was so sad. And that was my version of the Kennedy assassination. No other American is aware of it. They're taught all about Martin Luther King Jr. They're taught all about Kennedy's, both of them. And maybe even they're taught about Malcolm X. But two people that they would never hear about that were assassinated all at the same time were George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party. For obvious reasons, the Americans suppressed that assassination. And even further than him, they suppressed Richard Oakes Mohawk, who had taken over Alcatraz Island and almost brought the world to the brink of war with the recognition of an Indian American nation outside of the continental coastline of the United States. So that should put into perspective for many Americans what I have dealt with as a person growing up as an Indian, often assaulted as an Indian, certainly verbally so, if not physically. And I have no reason to love Americans. And I am constantly verbal about this. And of course, everyone in their ignorance takes it that because I was born in Asia, that I'm basically some kind of Chinese spy. And so I'm constantly told to go back to Asia or to China. Oftentimes people, when I'm exposing the reality of history to them as I do, and I tell Americans how they have lost every single war since World War I, which in a sense was a victory by default simply because of a weapon of mass destruction that they unleashed, known as the American Army Flu, later on propagandized as the Spanish Flu. You and I have spoken of it before, so people just need to go back in your archives, look up my name, they'll find the dirt on that particular influenza and how the Americans engineered it. The Richard Oakes was shot by Michael Morgan, my executrix producer. Just gave me the information on that. She acts as my secretarial assistant and looks up information for me while I'm on the air. He was a
your executrix. Your executrix? Is that she like an executive dominatrix? That's awesome. Hey, and speaking about the yelled, you know how like there's all these ignorant people out there, just really freaking stupid. And I was like, bro, something occurred to me this morning. The thing about brain damage due to fluoride is the one whose brain is damaged has no idea that there's a problem. It's those around them that have to put up with their lowered IQ and general arrogant stupidity.
Yes. Yeah, well, there you go. That's part of the problem, is somebody who is suffering. That's one of the things that President Ronald Reagan said when he became president. He was the oldest president in American history, and the concern was already out there of senility. People did not yet even know about Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or CJD, or the prion disorder, which he ultimately suffered from. So nobody really knew about Alzheimer's as we know it today, but they were asking, in their ignorance of Alzheimer's, he was asked by reporters about the potential for senility. And he said, oh, if I ever get senile, I will personally step down. Of course, the individual suffering from CJD or Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disorder, or what we today call Alzheimer's, which Reagan did all the while he was in office, they are the last people on Earth to be aware that anything is wrong.
Yeah. I've got Alzheimer's, and I said that I'd step down, but I forgot that I said. I'm sorry, bro.
Yeah. There you go. By the way, Morgan, Michael Morgan, who was the YMCA camp manager, again, blessings to my executrix producer, Laura Lee Solomon, who acts as my secretarial assistant while I'm on the air. Researches oftentimes my own notes or online, drags up a lot of stuff I've written in the past, such as columns, or investigates other columns others have written. That assassin of Richard Oakes Mohawk, Michael Morgan, was a YMCA camp manager who had a reputation for being rough with Native American children and was assaulting one in Richard Oak Mohawk's presence. When Oakes confronted him, Morgan responded by drawing a handgun and fatally shooting him. Morgan was charged with involuntary manslaughter, and the jury, which let him go, was told that the rough and violent American savage Indian had attacked him. And so Oakes died, of course, in California at the age of 30. And Michael Morgan went back to the YMCA, where he continued to rape Native American children the rest of his life. I remember that distinctly. This is America. And when I say I hate America, I mean it. I really hate America. And I hate the Constitutional Republic of the United States with a passion. God damn the Constitutional Republic of the United States. I want you all to hear it. I want you all to know it. I want you all to know that I'm here to watch you die. And as a constitutional republic, I want it to hurt. I want you all to know just how evil all of you truly are who are listening in the United States for supporting this constitutional republic, and that when Richard Oakes Mohawk took over Alcatraz Island and set up a Native American community there, basically the Americans viewed them as foreigners invading American territory, even though by all of the treaties that were signed by the United States government, any unused federal territories, which would include federal penitentiaries, were supposed to be returned to Native American Indians. All of these treaties were broken. In other words, the land was theirs because it had not been used in decades. The U.S. government had no intention of using it again, so the Indians were taking back land that was theirs. But the U.S. government wouldn't allow it. They had to have everything. And the United States Army, as I said, I knew the man who took his daughter out. The man who did that was a United States Army Ranger, and he did so under orders of the United States Army because the United States Army was still following a federal policy, an official policy, of the termination of all tribes, which was still in effect when Nixon was president. Now, think about what I'm saying, good people. The American government had a federal policy of termination of all tribes still in effect when Nixon was president, which was why he was able to get away with what he did. And
in Australia, they've done similar things to the Aboriginal population, and I think it only got outlawed maybe in 1967 or something. It became illegal to shoot Aboriginals. Before then, they were classified as fauna, so you could shoot any amount of Aboriginal people you wanted.
Well, I don't know if it was as bad as the United States, but I bet it was worse in some areas. But it's hard to be worse than the United States. There's an individual of mine, a friend of mine, who listens to my program. He lives in the Ozark Mountains, and this individual was telling me about his father, who just like it was, we're talking about the 60s, 70s, basically was watching from his porch, and they're living in the Ozarks. This is the Appalachian Mountains where everybody's got cars on tinder blocks, and people are kind of like smoking and joking, rocking back and forth on the chairs on the porch. Some Native American was refilling his canteen in a stream in front of them, and suddenly there's this loud bang, and he turns around, and one of his neighbors has just shot the Indian with a shotgun, and says, "Oh, that's the last Indian I've seen in generations," he says. "I bet, you know, decades at least," he said, "decades, and I bet that means that I won't be able to get another $20 again as easily as this." So by killing an Indian and turning in its scalp, they were able to get $20. That was, you know, this was in the 60s or 70s. Now, again, think about what I'm saying, people. You do not deserve to live as a society, Americans. You all deserve everything that happens to you, and I want it to hurt. So I do want you all to know this. And I enjoy every minute that I make you squirm, and when I basically give out historical realities that Americans just like hearing, and they come up with these vile comments on YouTube that they do, I enjoy it because they're all squealing like pigs and bitches about the fact that they're evil people who are getting whipped like the pigs and bitches that they are. And I'm saying that in the most general sense, and I wanted to hear it.
I just saw something that is so in line with this. It says, "America is at that awkward stage. It's too late to work within the system, but too early to shoot the bastards."
Yeah, absolutely. We're at that position where I constantly tell people, you don't need to worry about a revolution. The system is auto-destructing. Your greatest enemy is not the tyranny of a police state in any way, shape, or form. Your greatest enemy is anarchy. And that anarchy is coming upon us all too quickly. How that's going to affect New Zealand will be interesting, because obviously New Zealand's economy is beef. One of the greatest sources of its income then would be Asia, because the Asians do not have any land in which to substantially raise cattle. As a result, you have Kobe beef in Japan, which is an astronomical price, and you have little patches of land on which the Japanese raise cows as if they're people, massage them, give them alcohol, basically treat them as if they're four-legged, overgrown children, you know, like Americans or something like that. And then when they're ready for slaughter, Japanese basically take them in kindly and mercifully, without the cow being aware until maybe the last minute, kill them, and give you this beef, which is one of the most prized types of beef in the world. Now, of course, the cost is just beyond most people to afford, other than Japanese, because the rest of the world is so economically depressed. And in terms of China, of course, there's no place to raise cattle at all. People think of China as a very large nation. All of it is sand and dirt and rock and gravel. You can't eat that, and neither can, believe it or not, the cows. So because of that, the Chinese raise all kinds of different food that grows in very, very small areas on terraces, including the fish that they eat, which are often grown in what Americans would consider to be koi ponds. Only they're raising fish to eat. So you've got this situation where all of the major source of beef for China, which is eating more and more beef, just like the Japanese have, since they won the Second World War, which ended in 1952 per the Japanese-American Peace Treaty, signed at the Presidio Military Base of San Francisco on September 28th of 1951. I know, because I saw the documents, worked there for years, and they're available on the internet for anyone who cares to look them up. But nobody does. But in terms of the Japanese winning this war against the Anglo-American alliance, effective after the treaty on August 28th or so of 1952, you've got this situation where the Japanese were not eating meat. Now, of course, they're some of the beefiest people in the world, and they're consuming it all. Where does the majority of it come from? Either the United States or New Zealand. And a lot of that New Zealand beef goes to China. So what's going to happen when America collapses into anarchy? Then, of course, China collapses, because its entire economy is dependent on the American market, at which time, of course, New Zealand collapses. So we have a situation where the native peoples of America, New Zealand, Australia, other areas of the world where you've got these interconnected economies will finally come into their own again, almost inescapably. And by the way, my executrix producer did want you to know, Vinny, that the she did look up Echelon, and it was created in the 1960s, but formally recognized as existing in 1971. And so by the end of the 20th century...
God, it's that old!
Yes!
Sweet mercy! Like, before there was even, like, Atari, bro, they were listening to everything everybody ever said and chronicling and categorizing it with red flags for analysis using keyword encoders, giant underground freaking bases and stuff like that with satellite transmission fabrics and small children using little gear thingies to punch in the codes.
Yes, yes, and that's before you and I were born, more than likely. I was born in 1966, and I'm assuming you were born long after that. So
I was born in the ominous and ironic year of 1984.
Oh my goodness, well, doesn't that just go to figure? That's very
right
poetic.
At the very end of 1984.
There we have it. And
December 29th.
Excellent. So, well, we've got a while until your birthday, so we don't need to worry about you being 1 year older yet. But in terms of...
I'll be 31. It'll be terrible.
Oh, you'll be fine. That brings us back to the Third World War that you opened up the conversation with. I do want to get a bit into the classification and categorizations of these wars without overdwelling on or being pedantic. Before we get into that, let's contextualize some
Yeah. I love your pedantry, though.
I'm sorry, what?
You said you didn't want to be pedantic, but I love your pedantry.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
I mean, every time we listen to Dougie, it's like a veritable pantry of pedantry, and it's fantastic.
Well, I appreciate that. Let's go into a bit of it. Today's date is, of course, April 16th. Now, it's on this date...
We just ruined the rebroadcastability of this archive. Thank you. All right, go ahead.
On this day, hundreds of years ago, in 1746, the Redcoats beat the Highlanders at Culloden. And that, of course, is a big deal to all the Americans who are following the Outlander series, whether it be in book form or whether it be in television series form. That is a pivotal battle within that plot of that particular drama of time travel and feminine identity. And I do want people to know that you had the Scottish fighting for independence against a vile community of British people who were trying to exterminate them. That's another thing I find quite funny. I'll get on air and I'll talk about how the British were extracting, of course, what today would amount to billions and billions of dollars from their Treaty of Nanjing, which no one ever speaks about in terms of the Opium Wars. The British, of course, fought against the Chinese. I have a distant relation because I am, as opposed to an octoroon in the Native American sense, I'm a full 25% Chinese and a full 25% Japanese. So I am half Asian. I'm 50% Asian. Now, it's a distant relation of mine, Commissioner Lin, who fought the British in the Opium Wars. And when he fought the British in the Opium Wars, of course, many millions of Chinese died. His career was ultimately ruined. He had sacrificed it for the sake of the of his civilization. And an estimated 14 million Chinese were hooked on opium, shortly after he and his affiliates, which were basically the police forces of the Qing Dynasty of China, the Manchu Dynasty of China, they had lost to the British, and within a period of just a few years, 14 million Chinese were hooked on opium by 1900, the beginning of the 20th century. Now, in terms of the British, of course, they had extracted an enormous amount of money through the Treaty of Nanjing after millions of Chinese had been killed, and nobody ever remembers this. They keep speaking about the Japanese atrocity in Nanjing, the Nanjing Massacre, but they never talk about the $29 trillion in terms of what was extracted from China after the Opium War. They extorted then, through the Treaty of Nanjing in 1842, at the closure of that war, $21 million at the time. What in today's dollars would be $29 trillion. And so that goes to show how evil the British truly are. And I bring this up and I get British people writing me, how can we like this man who says we're evil? Oh, how dare you, mate? How am I supposed to listen to you? What am I supposed to say, that you're all good people? I mean, I really have to laugh. It's
it's like cutting both ways, man. It's like, it's a gray area. I'm sure there are plenty of Brits who are nice people, and I'm sure there's a number of them who are complete frickin' scum. Pedophile, satanic, murdering, invading, extorting, stabbing, shooting, war declaring, war crime scumbaggery, oil corporate scum. All right?
Well, this is where the million shades of gray come in the adult world, which is, of course, what most modern Westerners do not live with, because they grow up in a childhood fantasy of propaganda. Now, in the British, to a lesser extent, and to a far greater extent, the American mentality of fantasy, their data matrix, they grow up in a world of good guys and bad guys. Now, because the British have been around longer and have been so vile and so abusive in their behavior, it's pretty hard for them to deny how evil their society is.
And they've compensated for that by developing an incredible sense of humor and an entire different comedy spectrum, which I really enjoy, and I'm sure a lot of Americans would appreciate. So we'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry about that. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 4 days a week. By the way, American Freedom Radio has just changed its format to be a listener-supported network rather than full of advertisers and breaks and everything, because when you're tuning in, ultimately, we're radiophiles too. We love to listen to talk radio. We don't really like to listen to ads. But as talk radio show host, you do need a wee break at the end of every hour just to take a wiki leak or grab another coffee or something like that. So that's the way we're running it. And the only way that we can continue to do that for all of you is for the listening audience to compensate us for giving you the content by going to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and clicking on that donate banner. Bear in mind also that all the hosts on here are not doing it for the money either. We're not being paid to be here. We're here for a reason that you can't pay for. Loyalty. All right? Loyalty to the truth, loyalty to the free human race, and loyalty to American Freedom Radio. That's why we're here. If you want to support any of the individual hosts, you can look up our respective websites and donate. But the central hub is American Freedom Radio, and they do need your support regularly. Thank you very much. Now, my very special guest is Douglas Dietrich, and we were going on a Brit bashing binge there. It was
and you were talking how you like the humor, and that, of course, reminds me of Punch and Judy. I mean, you can't beat that when kids are raised on somebody who's taken a baseball bat and beaten everybody to death with it on stage.
I'm completely unaware with it, but I'm really, really loving the idea.
Oh, okay. That's you can look up Punch and Judy. They're very ancient. It's been around for hundreds of years in Britain, and of course, at any rate, to put this into perspective, I want people to be aware of what I am saying. Concerning whatever I do about Brits and about the Americans is to be taken in this light. Consider yourself a human being having either an Anglian or an American experience, and that you've done something horrible in a past life to have reincarnated in this fashion, and that you can karmically redeem yourself by at least becoming aware and acknowledging the evils of what either your empire or your constitutional republic has done. That will be a start towards a reincarnation into something less abusive to the environment and humanity. I think that you should look in the mirror, breathe deeply, say that to yourself every day. And, you know, there's fellow countrymen in England who have decided that they were going to do away with their Britishness. I'll give you an example in just a moment. And it has to do with something that Vincent Eastwood was talking about what the New Zealanders did in terms of taking the Māori and basically trying to live by them in peaceful coexistence, and how this led to the greatest wars between the indigenous populations and the European invaders, basically in the United States after U.S. military and the railroad industry, the original military industrial complex, took over both the United and Confederate States in a junta that was launched when General Rutherford B. Hayes stole the election from the man, Samuel Tilden, who legally won it by both popular and electoral vote. Everything was put in terms of the fix, the machine, a number of votes that were Democratic were discounted, and a number of Republican votes were put in their place falsely. This was all later on, by the way, confirmed. It is incontrovertible. And what happened was a Republican general by the name of Rutherford B. Hayes, an actual general in the U.S. military, took over the United States and became America's 19th president. And it was around that time that he wrote in March 13th, on 1887, a column that was put in all of America's newspapers from the president, alongside various editorials lauding their new military dictatorship. He put in a call to red Americans and basically said quite bluntly that by making all Indians of the United States full citizens of the Constitutional Republic with all the constitutional rights, it meant that all of the treaties that were signed with the Native Americans were null and void, as the government could not have treaties with its own citizens. So treaty land would now be open to the American public under the Homestead Act. So in return for executive recognition, Hayes demanded an act of faith on the part of the government, where service in the army on the frontier was required for all Indian males between the ages of 20 and 40. So he basically drafted all of the United States American Indians as, quote-unquote, Indian scouts to kill their own kind. Now, the man I described, the U.S. Army Ranger who killed Richard Mohawk's daughter, Richard Oakes' daughter, he was known as Richard Oakes the Mohawk, the man who killed his daughter was an Indian. He was a Native American who was acting as an American Indian scout for the U.S. Army under the policy of termination of all tribes. This was all in keeping with the policy that we're talking about was in continuity until the end of the Vietnam War, with the withdrawal in 1973. So I want people to understand just how truly, truly repugnant your social system is in the United States. Come to grips with that and condemn it. become aware of it, and condemn yourself as a U.S. citizen paying taxes to support it. Now, what can you do? You could do what perhaps some British citizen by the name of Paddy Roy Bates did in the United Kingdom. He was a former major in the British Army, and he proclaimed himself King of Sealand. Now, Sealand is not an island in the sand and beach and palm tree sense. Sealand is an artificial island constructed in the Second World War. And it was basically a helicopter landing pad. And yes, there were helicopters in the Second World War used by the Weltreich, the Empire of Japan, and the United Kingdom. And this individual who found this abandoned helicopter pad on concrete columns off the coast of England, Paddy Roy Bates, knew about it because he served on it as a British major when they were closing it down. And so he said, well, heck, they're abandoning it. I'll take over and declare myself king. And of course, he ran into all kinds of resistance from British diplomats and basically started in response minting his own stamps, his own coinage, printing his own currency. He sold titles and honors over the internet, and he used his own firearms to fire on British military vessels that tried to invade and take his island back. He even fought off a German saboteur who tried to kidnap his royal family and seize Sealand for himself. Now, this is in none of the British history books, and he's now diplomatically recognized as a sovereign nation by Germany and France. But of course, you never hear about this in the Commonwealth of Nations. The United Kingdom refuses to acknowledge his existence. But there is a king of Sealand off the coast of Britain that none of you know about. Now, you could either go that trip, such as taking over Alcatraz, or you could just wait for it all to come down where it's all heading anyway. So I want to give everybody food for thought and do forewarn them. There is no need for revolutionary violence or radical seizure of territory. If you can get away with such, more power to you in terms of the territorial sense. If you can do so without violence, all the better. But in terms of what's going on now about you, you need to prepare to survive the collapse of your governments, not the continuity or oppression from said governments. That is a fantasy, and all the people who promote that and tell you that that's what's going on are the people that you know are shills and the people you know are fronts for the government itself, because they're trying to give you the delusion that that government has the power to oppress you, the resources.
Well, that yeah. Or the people promoting it are themselves freaking delusional.
Yes, yes, there is that. Now, on this date in history, I did mention, of course, the Redcoats beating the Highlanders at Culloden in their desires to exterminate another Caucasian race, the Scelts, that were on the fringe, along with the Welsh, along with the Irish, along with the people on the Isle of Man, of the islands that were taken over by what we know today as Anglo-Saxons, which are basically a Germanic Romanized hybrid that has taken over the former Celtic islands, where all the Celts went to essentially die after the Roman Empire kicked them all off the continent of Europe. And then they had to face the worst of all, this hybrid race that became known as the Britons, that began to exterminate them on the areas surrounding basically London. And this went on for, of course, hundreds of years. And that continued until after the Battle of Culloden, literally just 115 years later, to the day, practically, for all intents and purposes, on April 15th of 1861, we had the official start of the United States Civil War, or the American War between the states. And what that was simply a continuity of the Anglo-Saxon extermination process against the Celtic fringe. What we had was basically an overwhelming white European descendant Anglo-Teutonic, most specifically Anglo-Dutch race or ethnicity in the northern states, as opposed to a Gallo-Celtic race of European descended Caucasians that
was
had developed.
Was that known as the Celtic-Skeltic, was it?
Something like that. So, to put this into perspective for people, that's why you've got that Scottish Rite masonry that was ripped off by the Ku Klux Klan, which is basically the southern version of, or what they use, to use the Celtic term, actually, properly, is Southron, the Southron version of the Palestinian Liberation Organization or the Irish Republican Army. So this is the difference between the two cultures. It is racial. The American Civil War was definitely a racial war between two Caucasian races on the North American continent, more properly nationalities in the modern sense. But more than that, it was operationally, tactically, militarily, a bridge between the Napoleonic Wars and, of course, the Great War, or World War I. Now, I mentioned the Napoleonic Wars. Historically, they are correctly World War Zero. They are the first war in which you had entire populations that were not only mobilized to wage war against other bordering populations with a modern revolutionary ideology. In other words, these weren't just nation states that were killing civilians overseas in the name of colonial enterprise. These were people who were killing each other because of radicalized ideologies, particularly on the part of the French. Now, what inspired the French, and who were they allied with? The Americans. The Americans, of course, had initiated the American Revolutionary War of Independence. Why did they do that? Because the King of England said, thus far, no farther, instituted the Royal Proclamation, said you will not go past the line that exists now as defined by the Appalachian Mountains in general. You will stay as a maritime series of colonies. And the Americans instituted what was the world's first and only conservative revolution. And they said, well, we're all a bunch of rich, white, plantation-owning, slave-owning pricks, and we want it all. We don't want this royal proclamation. We want to kill all them Indians and steal everything they have because what we've got is not enough. And so they launched what was the longest declared war in American history until the Second World War, 8 years long, from 1775, when that first shot fired was heard around the world, all the way until, 1800-something. What would be 8 years after 1775? You're better at math than I am, so I'll let you count that out, Vinny.
America. Just makes you feel so patriotic. You know, the pride swells in your breast.
But in terms of what happened with the American Revolution, the Americans ultimately supplanted this colonial ideology with a modern totalitarian ideology of constitutional republicanism. What were they all? They were the same kind of species of parasite that is now infesting and running New Zealand. They were Freemasons. Now, what exactly is Freemasonry? They're deists. It is a cult of the religion, if you can dignify it with such a title, of deism. Now, what is deism? Deism is the theology, though, based on the revolutionary concept in physics that was established by Sir Isaac Newton. Now, Sir Isaac Newton was the last of the alchemists. He was very much an alchemist, to the point where, by the way, my executrix producer is allowing me to know that the American Revolution ended in 1783. So it was from 1775 to 1783. Thank you so much, dear lady. And in order to continue with what I was saying about, of course, our friend Sir Isaac Newton, he was enough of an alchemist where he literally poisoned his mind mixing chemicals together. He had to be committed to an insane asylum. He was ultimately released because of his royalty or his nobility. He was definitively sociopathic. He felt that lesser peoples who were of lower caste or class were not human beings. And because of this, he was one of the people who was very much an advocate of debtors' prison and various other social injustices that ultimately led to the British invention of great things that civilized the rest of the world, like child labor and slums. Ghettos and the like. So with this kind of background, drug abusers like the Huxleys made statements that the world would not be a better place if we had more Sir Isaac Newtons among us. But Sir Isaac Newton also developed a revolution in physics. And his revolution...
Can I just add something in here? Back on the subject of fluoride, when you reduce the IQ by like a point, what you do is you half the number of geniuses and you double the amount of severely disabled. That's probably why we don't have any Isaac Newtons.
Right, yeah,
that's or enough.
But it's kind of like a choice. You're kind of damned either way. I mean, do you want somebody who's brilliant and sociopathic and entirely pretty much a functional Asperger syndrome type of individual who has no empathy whatsoever with the implications of what he's doing? Or would you rather have a bunch of idiots who are at least less of a threat?
I don't know. I'd rather have dominion over my own body and my own life, and if I'm not hurting anybody or damaging anybody's stuff, then nobody should ever be able to force me, touch me, or tell me to do anything I don't want to do.
There you are. Did you say you were joining Patty on Sealand, or were you going to do something else? But at any rate, without the option for most of us, to join Paddy Roy Bates on his island kingdom, as recognized by many on the European continent in terms of national recognition, what we're stuck with is living in our nightmare world between the Sir Isaac Newton and the marching morons who have been impacted by the fluorides he probably ultimately generated by his calchemical experiments. But in terms of his ideology, he promoted a revolution in physics known as Newtonian mechanics. This created the concept of the clockwork universe. This clockwork universe gave many intellectuals who were educated, which meant they were rich, because no unfortunate peasant, that includes people in the Americans, people, the Americans who were all enlisted men, were peasants. These were people who tilled the field. They could not leave it. They were married to the soil for obvious reasons. They were subsistence, excuse me, my English, I signify many words, subsistence agricultural farmers. And because they existed off subsistence agriculture, if they left to fight a war for just a season, their family would starve to death. So all of them had to be paid. This is the difference between a non-commissioned officer and a commissioned officer. Anyone who's a private to a sergeant or a warrant officer is non-commissioned. That means that if you don't get paid, you don't have to fight. Whereas a commissioned officer, someone who's educated, the George Washingtons and the various other people who were the nobility of the U.S. Army back in the days of the American Revolution, the people who had something to lose. These people were, of course, commissioned in the sense that they were part of the incorporated states of America. They held stock in the nation. That meant they had to fight all the way till it went to the ground. They could not leave. They're married to the nation as opposed to the soil, the constitutional republic, the incorporated state. They have something to lose if the state goes down, whereas the subsistence agricultural farmer can go back and start himself anew. Now, because of this, many people died, many families died, because this was the longest declared war in American history until World War II. So with all of these people dying of plague, of starvation, famine, George Washington, you would think, at the end of this war, as, of course, was outlined by my executive producer to be 1783, you would think he would give his version of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But no, on September 3rd of 1783, the Peace of Paris was signed, and the American War for Independence officially ended. And at the end of that revolution, George Washington gave his version of a Lincoln-esque Gettysburg Address, and he mentioned how admirable his fellow officers were, all these plantation-owning, slave-owning, property-owning whites. But he mentioned not one word about his enlisted men. Not only that, but they never paid them. And because of that, all the enlisted men who had suffered for 8 years, many of whose families had literally died, had perished, came back for their pay in what became known as Shays' Rebellion. Now, Shays' Rebellion was put down, and all the veterans, the enlisted men who fought in your American Revolutionary War of Independence, were hanged.
Which in French is called touché.
Yes, yes. Now, well, in my signified English, I used to say they were hung. That, of course, turned out to be quite incorrect and meant something else. They may have been hung, but they were essentially hanged. Either way, they were effed. And because they were effed, this is what your American culture is based on. You've got a bunch of Freemasons who are running this where everybody who's non-commissioned is expendable. You are dirt. You are nothing to them. As a matter of fact, the original Declaration of Independence said life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. But they knew they couldn't get any of these suckers working the field to fight for that because none of them owned property. They were like serfs in Tsarist Russia. They were farming property that they leased from the big, white, plantation-owning, slave-owning pricks like Thomas Jefferson. So they put in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, what does that mean? I mean, what if your happiness is child molestation? Now, what if your happiness on a freeway while driving is to drive while drunk and speeding and weaving and taking out families in other cars? Of course,
I must say that is enjoyable when I've done it, you know.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you something. All of this is meaningless because one person's happiness oftentimes, unfortunately, is another person's tragedy. So what they meant was it was their happiness to rape you, to weave you off the highway, to do whatever they wanted to you. And if you translate that to Chinese, literally, there's no concept of independence. The closest thing the Chinese have is a character, an iconograph, meaning something similar to the criminal mindset. Indeed, the very criminal mindset of F everybody, every man for himself.
So well, in our time frame, that character is called Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, well, there you go. And that's how the Declaration of Independence transliterates into Chinese. Translates as basically a criminal document where a bunch of criminals got together and said, F everybody, every man for themselves. That's exactly
again,
how the U.S.
Again, the Nixon administration comes to mind.
Every administration comes to mind. But what's in common?
There's just no escape from the scumbaggery.
Yes. Well, what comes to mind? The Freemasons. That brings us back to the religion. What was the religion of George Washington? That which was based on Newtonian mechanics and the cosmology of the clockwork universe.
Have a look at the pictures online. You just search George Washington inauguration, and he's wearing Freemasonic garb. He's wearing an apron, the white gloves, the whole nine yards. It was a Masonic inauguration ceremony.
That was because it was a conservative revolution of slave-owning, plantation-owning deists, Freemasons. Now, the deists, back to that, that is the concept of the clockwork universe based on Newtonian cosmology, in which God created a universe as a mechanism, wound it up, and let it go, and abandoned it. It is the universe of a God gone away. With the God gone away, then the Masons step in, and they can take the throne. They fulfill his place. They are the new gods. That's Freemasonry. That's what's moving to New Zealand, because it has totally screwed up the United States to the point where they can no longer stay here. The United
States... One of my listeners asked me, so Vinny, how expensive is farmland in New Zealand? And I said, well, let me put it like this. If you want to buy a major piece of farmland, the only two people who are apparently able to afford it is giant Chinese conglomerates and James Cameron.
Well, there you go. I mean, that says quite a bit. And believe me, as far as I'm concerned, James Cameron is the greater evil. But in terms of where we're at, I hope that puts that into some perspective for people. The Freemasons, your founding fathers, are not members of some Christian revolution. They were part of a conservative, godless revolution. They were as atheistic as the Bolsheviks. This is why the United States ultimately aligned with the Soviet Union. This is why there was never a Third World War between the United States and the Soviet Union. These were both godless empires. Get that through your heads, people. And as we get to that point, where we're finally absorbing that, and I was talking about the Napoleonic War, which took place after the American Revolution War, the Americans lost. They had allied with the French were ultimately defeated, and the Russians occupied Paris. Now think about what I'm saying. The Russians occupied Paris. This is how badly they lost. This was at the point when Napoleon had invaded Moscow. No one was there because it was abandoned, comes back home, and is ultimately facing foreign occupation where the Russians have made it all the way into Paris. And by the way, that couldn't have been done in World War II because of the T-34s and the nature of logistical tie-down to mechanized warfare. The T-34s, all of the landscape of Europe roughly changes once you leave Berlin. Once you get out into Western Europe, the T-34s are useless. This is why the Soviets were so badly beaten in the Korean Peninsula. This hot rod of a tank, which all the Americans have this fetish for, is utterly useless in mountainous terrain. So you've got this difference between different wars. In World War Zero, the Napoleonic conflicts, the Russians were able to make it to Paris. Not so World War II. There was a logistical reason why they stopped. Now, in terms of where we got with the Napoleonic Wars, because the Americans lost, they were beaten by the Canadians. And the Americans hate this. You have no idea, Vinny, how violent they get. When I tell them
the Canadians... Was this the War of 1812, where the British came across the Canadian border and burned down the White House?
Well, let's get this straight, Vinny. That wasn't the British. The British were running a global empire. They were fighting Napoleon worldwide. The Napoleonic Wars were a single conflict. They were waged all over the world, including Dutch Indonesia, the largest archipelago in the world. They were waged in the Western Hemisphere in terms of the fight against the establishment of the world's first black republic on the island of Haiti, or Haiti, as it's known in the Creole of the Haitian dialect. Now, that meant that this war was fought in a manner that was far more, It was more far-reaching geographically in many respects than World War I. So you've got this all this collection into what is properly known as World War Zero. The War of 1812 was a battle, was the Battle of 1812. The British didn't have the manpower or the resources to invade North America, so they asked the Canadian colonials to do so. Now, there's this fantasy that the Americans harbor, which is entirely delusional, that British Royal Marine commandos came in and burned Washington to the ground. Now, no matter how good a commando unit is, there's only limits to what it can do. They could not take out a city until you give them a nuke. Now, because they didn't have nukes at the time of the Battle of 1812, they had to send in the Canadians. So the Canadian forces invaded it. They burned Washington to the ground, and they burned down the White House, which was at that time was pink. So the Americans got their asses kicked.
So they were like, okay, I guess we're burning down the pink house today.
Yes, that's right. And so the Americans, of course, sued for peace. And as a result, if you take a look at American publications, now as a military research librarian, I can tell you this, inarguably, one of the flagship journals of the historian's profession in the United States is the American Historical Review. Now, the last time that I had checked, which was around 2007, they had not published a single article on Napoleonic military history for over 30 years. So when the Americans lost World War Zero as part of the alliance of radicalized revolutionary republics with the French, what was their response as a nation? Well, let's never write about it. So Americans grow up to this day thinking all kinds of fantasies, like the irrational one where a squad of Royal British commandos, maybe about five men, come in and burn Washington to the ground. And when I said, no, the Canadians kicked your ass, they defeated the U.S. Army. They marched into the Capitol. And Americans, oh, they get violent. They do various conniptions and convulsions. And, yes, I like to see it. I like to see their pain. I want it to hurt. So, yes, we go through that again today, and there's no way they can argue. So, with that in mind, of course, what is my point in talking about the Napoleonic conflicts? They were World War Zero. World War One came after that. World War Two is very much still with us. There is no World War III because the Americans cannot declare a third world war. They can never legally declare a third world war until they end their war with the Third Reich. The war with Japan ended in Japanese victory. Now, the Americans who are antithetical to that, of course, we could go in for hours. I don't want to divert the show in that direction. But obviously, they've lost every war they fought in Asia. They lost in Korea. They lost in Vietnam. Why do they think, in their delusional fantasy, that they somehow won a war in Japan? Now, at the same time that the Americans were fighting the Vietnam and the Korean Wars, what did they do? They occupied those nation states as geographical entities. They occupied Vietnam all the while they were fighting the Vietnamese. They occupied Korea all the while they were fighting the Koreans. They occupied Japan all the while they were fighting the Japanese. And that army was in China, where the civil war between the Chinese communists and the nationalists continued until 1950, shortly before the Japanese-American peace treaty, which was signed in 1951. I know because I was born in the Nationalist Republic of China as reestablished on the island of Taiwan, which was a Japanese island. And it was a Japanese island nearly the size of Japan itself, which was never invaded. The Americans never invaded Taiwan. It was too large for them to invade because they didn't have the resources or the manpower. It would have been another D-Day. So they had to do a Marine Corps invasion on Okinawa. Now, this is what really gets to me is the insanity of Americans because, of course, I hear this all the time. If Japan and Germany won the war, why do we still have bases in Japan and Germany? This is the insanity of America. You want to talk to just total batshit, effing crazy. You look at an American, because they'll say that again and again as if it's true. It's like saying the sky is black or green or that the moon is pink. It makes no sense. It doesn't even physically exist. in the year of 1989, the Soviet Union, while it still existed, the Fifth Republic of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States signed peace with both East and West Germany. They needed this because they needed the Deutschmark to float the euro. And because of that, they signed peace with nations that did not even exist in the Second World War. Eastern Germany, Western Germany did not declare war against the Allies. But peace was made with them, as well as a removal of all occupation. The Soviet troops withdrew. The American troops withdrew. The French and British troops withdrew. Germany hasn't been occupied since 1989. That's many decades by this point. But Americans are so total batshit effing crazy, they think they still occupy Germany. This is how crazy they truly are. As a population. As individuals. And you talk to them, and they'll believe it. It's like saying, we have men living on the moon. They may as well be saying, we have men living on the moon. Then they'll say, we still got troops in Japan. No, they're not in Japan. They're in Okinawa. Okinawa has its own flag. Okinawa has its own culture. It is Sinitic. It once belonged to China. And if you look it up, you'll find out something that you may never have known. They eat pork. Unlike the Japanese, who never ate meat. The Japanese were vegetarian. They ate fish. They're not vegan. They're vegetarian. There's a difference. Americans don't know this. Again, because they're pridefully ignorant. But the Japanese had an entirely different culture, whereas the Ryukyu Islanders of Okinawa ate pork. Now, one of the pointed aspects of this was the Americans decided to exterminate the Okinawans. So when the Americans invaded the island of Okinawa, they killed every single pig on the island of Okinawa so the Okinawans would starve to death the next winter. Now, one of the reasons you know Japan won the war was because the Japanese forced the Americans to ship entire merchant marine shiploads of pigs to the island of Okinawa so that the Okinawans would not starve. That was one of the Japanese victory conditions. So every pig on the island of Okinawa today is an American pig. And I mean that in every sense of the entendre. So keep that in mind, Americans. You have no bases in Japan. They're on Okinawa, where you are stranded with a bunch of Marines and various other military personnel on an island which the Japanese have been negotiating with for years to liberate so that they can ultimately remove your filthy foreign presence from Okinawa, so that Asia will be a bit more clean, because all the Americans have done, their behavior was so atrocious during their invasion of Okinawa. I want everyone to know this. More Okinawans killed themselves to avoid rape or torture by the Americans, who were so vile. They were cooking and eating them alive. I am not kidding. And so the Okinawans, to evade that fate, killed themselves, and more Okinawans killed themselves during the American invasion, known as Operation Iceberg, the Japanese were killed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki put together. Try to process that, people. Think about what I'm saying. Think about the pure evil of yourself, and think about what the Americans did, and their behavior has never improved. Every other month in Okinawa, you'll read about Americans of any service branch raping Okinawan schoolgirls. And it's always little girls, and it's always groups of big, strapping American men who get together and rape them. That's why they're kept behind cages in a large internment camp so that they don't go out and rape everybody. Otherwise, they would kill everybody on the island because that's just what Americans do. So they're kept in cages and they are forbidden to interact with the normal Okinawan public. They're on curfew.
I've encountered a lot of very, very annoying American tourists, and I think this is exactly the type of processing facility we need here in New Zealand. Big fences, barbed wire, electrified, keep them out from raping the small New Zealand children, you know? I'm just joking, but go ahead.
Well, I thank you for adding the humor into what would otherwise be a rather, shall we say, morbid topic.
But, hey, you can totally make jokes about rape. It just depends where the exaggeration is.
Well, it's certainly one of those things like Vinny and I, when we make jokes about genocide, we have to laugh or else we're going to cry. Basically, Vinny and I are stuck in a position where we may seem somewhat mad or maniacal in our cackles. But honestly, if we did not maintain the sense of humor, we would have disintegrated into serial mass murderers long time ago.
Yeah, bro. I mean, look. Life is too serious to take seriously. That's all I'll say.
Absolutely. And so to bring us back to the Third World War, definitely it's something which is not going to happen because the United States is still legally at war with the Third Reich in exile, just as Korea, both North and South, are legally at war with each other, just as the island nation onto which I was born, the Nationalist Republic of China, as reestablished on the island of Taiwan, is still legally at war with Communist China, or nominally Communist China, on the mainland. And so, too, America is still legally at war with the Third Reich in exile, as is the United Kingdom. Now, the Soviet Union disintegrated. It's no longer at war with the Third Reich in exile. That's one of the reasons why the Americans and the Britons now consider it an enemy. At the time of the Chinese Civil War, it's very important to remember, the Americans supported the Soviets, and they supported the Chinese communists. Now, more Chinese died fighting each other as nationalists and communists than were killed by the Japanese. And the Japanese killed 100 million Chinese. Now, you go way over that number, and you'll find out how many died in the Communist Nationalist Civil War. And because of that, the Americans sided with their communist allies, and the Nationalist Chinese allied with Japan. That's why, without an invasion, the Nationalist Republic of China wound up reestablished on the Japanese island of Taiwan. And as a result, it's no longer recognized by the United Nations. So, when I talked about those four nations settling in peace with East and West Germany, one needs to ask, hey, there were five allies who were on the United Nations Security Council when it was established on January 1st of 1942, just 3 weeks and 3 days after Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941. Those allies were Nationalist China amongst the United Kingdom, the French, the Soviets, and the Americans. Where did the Chinese go? Well, they were no longer recognized because since the Americans supported the communists, their blood enemies, they had to ultimately become a member of the Anti-Comintern Pact. And the Anti-Communist International Pact was the Axis. That's why they basically became an Axis member state as soon as Italy dropped out. And when the Americans, of course, gained what they did on the Italian peninsula, which wasn't much, they never made it into the north, into the Salo Republic. The Americans, of course, gained a new enemy of a billion people in the form of China. And Nationalist China was kicked out of the United Nations Security Council, and the Communist Chinese were brought in. This is why your world is so topsy-turvy. But nobody, no American, sits there with his jaw dropping to the ground saying, I thought the Chinese was our allies. Why are they no longer there and their enemies, the communists, are in? No, they sit there like an insane lunatic saying, oh, the Chinese were our allies. And they say that like a mantra against reality because that's all it is. No, we were not because we didn't need to be your allies. And I say that as a Chinese national.
No disrespect, but you're way off base. Okay. You go and ask an American, so who did we defeat in World War II? And they'll go, China?
Thank you. You're right. Oh, how could I have been so blind? So true.
Yeah. Who were our allies in World War I? And they go, Germany?
Well, you're right. Oh, how could I? You're right. You're absolutely right. Now, the Britons or the Britons. Hey,
sweet mercy, Dougie. I mean, like, for the sake of accuracy here.
Yes. Oh, I need these corrections. Otherwise, I'll truly meander off into areas that just have no basis in.
But don't worry. I'm sure it's a lot worse than I make it out.
Yes. Well, the Britons are almost as bad. Yes, the Britons are educated into thinking of the Germans as their eternal enemies. They don't remember them as their allies during the Napoleonic Wars or World War Zero at all. They are basically stuck on World War One and World War Two, and both the British and the American media machine is mobilized for constant killing of Nazis. Yeah,
well, I think the British are so poorly misinformed. They reckon they conquered the world on the backs of cups of tea, but it was actually opium and gin.
Yes. Don't forget rum and slaves. Lots and lots of slaves. And
let's not forget the slaves.
Oh, yes. That's well, we have this situation, obviously, where we're confronted with prideful ignorance, which is the worst kind of ignorance at all. People are not only ignorant, but they're proud of it and demanding the right to maintain it. Now, that is something which should not be a right. Ignorance is a sin, because if you're ignorant of the road signs, you are endangering the lives of everyone else, women and children, families, school buses that are on that road. So we all have to be knowledgeable in the road signs. Well, history is nothing but a collection of road signs. So what I'm giving everyone is the road signs. Now, the reason I'm making it so painful is because you're not going to remember it otherwise. If I did this pleasantly and said, I love you all, nobody would remember a word I said, because I would not be a threat. But because I tell everyone that, geez, you're a bunch of rotten people, whether you're British or American, then they pay attention. So if they pay attention, they have an opportunity to learn. And that's what's important. And I think that's why Vinnie Eastwood himself is kind of in the gray area between popular and unpopular. I mean,
I'm extremely hated and extremely loved at the same time.
There we are. Well, what can you expect from somebody who has a cannabis leaf across his torso? Now, I'm going to butcher this completely. What is the captain figure that you represent yourself on as the econ that I see on Facebook or on your banner? Is Captain Aerotorvia?
You know how you hurt yourself and you go, ow!
Yeah.
And you know how you cry and you shed a tear?
Yes.
And you know when you got to get from one side of the lake to another, you need a rower?
Yeah.
It's pronounced Aotearoa.
Aotearoa. Captain Aotearoa. And that is the new cinema blockbuster that needs to be produced so that we can get maybe something. Well, if it's not intelligent, at least it's a social statement.
The thing is, we need to take the franchise to the next level. I think, you know, like incorporating a giant particle accelerator to light my weed, you know, that'll be fantastic.
Well, there you go.
Because sequels are all about pushing the envelope, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Now, speaking of pushing the envelope, are you hearing anything that far down south? I'm going to be a bit pigheaded here and stereotypical. I'm going to assume the worst. And I'm going to assume you don't hear much about it unless you're looking for it. But what do New Zealanders know about the genocide of the indigenous population as conducted by the largest Islamic state in the world in Indonesia, where Islam is the state religion? And, of course, it's been soured by a lot of corporate contracts from the United States.
We're talking about the East Timorese, are we?
No. That was definitely formerly a possession of Portugal. They were heavily Catholicized. They did not want to be citizens in a government which recognizes Islam as the state religion. And as a result, there was a long, bloody war that has led to the Timor-Leste, or Free Timor.
Well, war is when you've actually got two sides fighting. This is more of an extermination.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. Nevertheless, there was a victory in the sense that the victims of that extermination on what is today recognized as Timor-Leste did gain international recognition. We're hoping the same will happen for what I'm thinking of, which is Irian Jaya, or West Papua New Guinea. Timor-Leste?
It sounds like some kind of a dessert made with a blowtorch.
That's all it was for Australia, because they have a huge natural gas field off the coastline, which the Australians want a lot of dig in without a lot of defense.
If you think that's a big gas field, you should see the parliament, bro.
Oh, there you have it. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing can beat that. Now, hopefully, someday, we will have some kind of national state for the Maori of A.R. Oh, God. Aure.
Like, owl like an elbow, tear like a drop, and roa like a lake. Aotearoa.
Am I doing that right?
Yeah, and the Maori, like a cat, goes meow, and then I don't know if there's a word that's like re or something like that, but Maori.
Okay, Maori, and
it's close enough and kind of cute too. What do you say?
Aotearoa. So Captain Aotearoa here is. I want to know do you have any impression at all of what's going on with the genocide, culturally and otherwise, of the indigenous people that's going on in West Papua New Guinea, what is known as Irian Jaya by the Islamist occupation government of Indonesia?
No. I think they think Iliman Jaya is some kind of African mountain that's inaccessible.
Well, I thought so. I thought so, because in New Zealand, people think of it, and this is American geographic ignorance, people think of New Zealand as being something like Australia. The truth is, New Zealand is a world of its own. It is truly fallen off the face of the earth in a large part.
Oh, dude, like, you know how different LA is to New York? You know, it's like calling LA and New York as both the same kind of American. It's like, no. One yes. will invite you into their home and give you like a whole bunch of food and then take you out of the pool and give them the sun and give you a Bud Light. And the other one will tell you to keep on stepping.
Yes. Now, what would be the analogy in terms of New Zealanders and Australians?
Well,
which one would be more the Angelino and which one more the New Yorker?
Well, let me put it like this. Do you know what the difference is between Australians and cheese?
No.
If you leave cheese in a desert for 200 years, it develops some form of culture.
get me started. At any rate, so I do want to say that the conversation has kind of warned me for the moment. I do want people to recognize the fact that the next day, tomorrow, the 17th, as a historical day, will be the anniversary of the 1,300 Cuban exiles who invaded Cuba during the Bay of Pigs incident. This occurred in 1961. It was half a decade before I was born, and that is the anniversary which we're facing tomorrow. Now, there is something there that resonates with what I've discussed with the Battle of Culloden and the official start of the American War between the states. And what resonates there is, again, an anti-communist insurgency that was failed in terms of its logistical supply system, in that its sponsor state, the United States, did not pull through with air support or support of any kind whatsoever. And for this reason, while he was alive, President John F. Kennedy was reviled and hated. Modern Americans do not understand this, nor do postmodern Americans, the younger generations. They're raised with an American guilt complex where they're told everybody loved Kennedy. The Kennedy administration was Camelot. When he died, everybody was weeping. The reality is everybody was weeping when he died, but everybody was weeping probably because they weren't in line to kill him first. That is the way it was felt at the time. People today are in total denial of that, just as they are of World War II. In the Second World War, of course, the Australians took people of German ethnicity and they put them in internment camps, as they had during World War I. And in America, of course, we had internment camps for, in the main, Japanese, in the sense that every single United States citizen of Japanese ethnicity was interned. But we had also interned in the United States many people of German and Italian ethnic descent. So we have no memory of this in the United States, and it needs to be brought to the foreground along with the kind of mentality that the so-called Greatest Generation had, which was one of extermination and genocide. They wanted all of the Japanese dead. They would have killed them if the Japanese had not won the war. And yet Americans have warped this and woofed this in their brains to some kind of Club Med where all the Japanese turned themselves in for self-protection from American lynching after Pearl Harbor, or some kind of deranged fantasy like that. And just incidentally, by the way, giving up all of their financial and property resources, all of their homes, all of their real estate, everything they had in the bank, every single asset that they owned. So as a result, basically this was very equivalent to what the National Socialists did with the Jewish population. Do Americans remember that? No. They're raised to kill Nazis because Nazis are evil, because they do that to people who look white. So as a result, you've got every Briton and every American growing up to kill those evil Jewish-killing Germans. What's so ironic about this that I do want people to know on either side of the Pacific is the fact that today the Jews are streaming back to Germany. It is far safer to be a Jew in the modern Vereinigte Deutschland, or United Germany, than it is to be a Jew in Israel. You have far more of a chance of dying in Israel of an act of violence, what we are told is terrorism, depending on how you define it, whether you are
so aware. Are you saying that there's like some kind of reverse exodus going on right now, like a revexodus?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good word for it. And leave it to a punster like Vinnie Eastwood to think of a clever term that will probably become a neologism in the very near future.
This is the only way I can make a living at being a huckster, so...
I'll need to learn your tricks. Well, most certainly, the Jews are a protected species, so to speak. Not to read too deeply into that term, I assure you. But definitely, they're treated as if they were an endangered animal or something of that nature. They're heavily protected by the police in Germany. No one would dream of harming or touching a Jewish person in Germany today. And as a result, whenever you do hear of a crime committed by some neo-Nazi or fascist in Germany, you learn of it in newspaper headlines worldwide. It's that exceptional. You never read about it in newspaper headlines worldwide because it doesn't happen. Germany, of course, is very much an independent nation, united. It is not occupied, hasn't been so for many decades. It is the friendliest place for Jews on earth today. Most Jews are returning there whose families were wiped out during the time of the Third Reich. And as they're returning there, the majority of them would say, I infinitely prefer it here as opposed to Israel, which is an armed camp in a constant state of war, apartheid, and oppression.
I'd probably say that also because the train carriages have improved a lot since they were last in Germany as well.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. That's... We got to be careful, obviously. We're going to get knocked off here.
Look. If you can't take a joke, okay, then you're being freaking too serious, all right? There's plenty of things that can be taken seriously. There's lots of people who do take them seriously, and seriously enough for the both of us. So I'll tell you what, we'll provide some kind of ironic counterpoint, and then people can either kill us or laugh, and I think that they should laugh, because I'm pretty sure I don't want to be exterminated for making a crap joke. My very special guest, nonetheless, has been Douglas Dietrich. Ladies and gentlemen, Douglas, thank you very much for coming on here. And unfortunately, this is the end of the show. I'd like to remind people that the archives for this will be available on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and also if you go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, you can see the affiliates website there. Many New Zealanders don't even know that I'm on 22 AM FM stations in New Zealand, and a number of international radio networks as well syndicate the broadcast. Thank you very much for supporting me and all your regular donations. They've literally helped me to survive, as I hope that humanity will as well. See you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for listening.